We have one left, and your agenda list, Perry Jones and Mindy Erickson. And Mindy has turned over the whole talk to Perry Jones, so we will welcome him up at this time to talk about the groundwater and surface water exchanges at White Bear Lake and other North and East Metro lakes. Perry Jones is a hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, Minnesota Water Science Center. His research includes groundwater and surface water exchanges in lakes, wetlands, and hydrologic characterization of potential mining areas. So thanks for agreeing to talk today, and welcome.
All right, thanks for having me here today. Let me lower this a little bit. There you go. I'm here to talk about a three-year project that we're completing. It's looking at characterizing groundwater surface water interactions in the Northeast Metro. I first like to recognize the co-authors, Mindy, obviously, and Jared Trost is here. He's done a lot of work on the study. But I'd also like to recognize the efforts of Met Council, Lanyon, and others for helping out with the project, as well as Minnesota Department of Health and the legacy funds. So hopefully I get this right. Oh, here we go. Okay, so the project really, there's two reports that are going to come out on the study. One is already published, the other is in almost in draft form. And the first report really conquers two analyses. One was a statistical analysis of lake water fluctuations and trying to figure out what parameters, either some kind of climatic, landscape, or geologic factors that are controlling, can explain some of the lake level variability. And Jared was the lead on that portion of the study. And that's published in our first report, as well as this section, which is characterizing groundwater and surface water exchanges. And that's published in that report, and that's what I'm going to focus on today. We also have another project where we're developing a groundwater flow model for the Northeast Metro area to try to get a better handle on characterizing those groundwater surface water exchanges in lakes in the Northeast Metro, and then really looking at what the regional effects are of groundwater withdrawals on those interactions as well as on lake levels. So I said we're going to focus today in talking about the field assessment work that we did in characterizing groundwater surface water interactions. And these are kind of developed into looking at water quality analysis, specifically stable isotopes. And we also did some age dating. I won't talk too much about that. We had some results that weren't as favorable as I'd hoped for the study. But I'll talk about the stable isotope work as well as another tool that I found really useful. And that's the continuous seismic reflection work. And then I'll focus in on White Bear Lake and some work we did there looking at interactions with shallow and deep waters. And that involved some lake coring work that we did with the University of Minnesota LACOR facility, as well as looking at installing deep water piezometers and looking at water levels in those piezometers and in comparison to lake levels. And then also some seepage flux meter work we did with Don Rosenberry, who's a research hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. So stable isotope work. This was work we did back in 2014. And it involved collecting water samples from lakes as well as rainfall in lake piezometers that we installed and the wells. And what we focused on was the oxygen and hydrogen ratios, and this is a valuable tool we found out in the study we did for White Bear Lake back in 2013 that really helped us define what the contributions of water, of potential surface water, to wells in the area. And we expanded this work to look at the entire Northeast Metro area. Okay, so first, for the lakes that we worked with and precipitation samples, we collected monthly water samples between May and October of 2014 from four lakes, Big Marine, Turtle, White Bear, and Bald Eagle Lake. And we did that to establish kind of a seasonal trend, at least for that 1 year, as how the isotope signature changes. We also collected precip samples at a station we developed at White Bear Lake, and we then compared the results from the precip as well as the lake to get some idea as far as inner exchanges. And this is a plot, a graph showing the oxygen ratios of 18 to 16 versus the hydrogen isotope ratios. And if you look, the values that are in the triangles that are, let's see if I can get this, right up in this area, those represent those monthly values we collected from the lake waters. And you can see there, they follow a general trend line that we established for the evaporation. It's a basically evaporation line for the lakes in the Northeast Metro. And if you look at the green dots, those represent the isotope signatures for the rainfall. And the black line that runs pretty close to those is actually a meteoric water line that was established by Matt Landon and others in Princeton, Minnesota. And so really what our samples are saying is that it does a pretty good job of representing that meteoric water line. And so we could use that then to compare to the water samples we collected from the wells as well as the lakes. So we mentioned that we looked at stable isotopes, and we collected water samples from 40 wells. Each of these wells was either open to the Prairie du Chien, Jordan, or both aquifers. And we were all collected in October of 2014. And again, we were looking at the oxygen and hydrogen isotopes. And so this was the plot. The red dots indicate the actual isotope signatures for those 40 wells. And the blue triangles, again, represent the isotopes for those lakes that we sampled. And one thing we found was, again, that there's a strong relationship where we can see that that exists between the wells and the lake. And we use that as a comparison to estimate the percentage of surface water contribution to those wells, because wells that were located close to the Meark water line or on the Meark line represent wells that really are getting most of their water from the groundwater system. You're not seeing a lot of surface water contribution to those. Whereas wells, for instance, like this one well 3, is almost getting all surface water as far as component. And so we use that that relationship then to come up with a percentage and look at that distribution. And this is each of those points represents, again, that percentage of contribution of groundwater versus surface water, and these are all the locations of the wells. And you note here is White Bear Lake. And one thing we found was, and we found this with the White Bear Lake study also, is that the wells we sampled that were south of White Bear Lake had percentages, pretty large contributions of surface water contributions, some as high as 50-60%. And these are wells that are fairly deep, and they're all in the Prairie du Chien. They're probably about 400-500 feet down. Now there's one well, that well 3, where it had all surface water contribution. At least that's what the surface water signature was indicating. And one thing we did was we also collected water samples for dissolved gases. And one thing we found is that this well also had the highest methane concentrations. It was an order of magnitude higher than all the other wells. And so where that methane gas is, what we're postulating is that we've got the well sits right in between two lakes, Otter Lake and Amelia Lake. And what we think is that the water from those lakes is probably going into the sediment, picks up methane gases, which form in the organic material, and then it flows into the well and it actually gets brought up with the well. And so it gives us more evidence that there's a lot of interactions that are occurring in these areas. Now there's some places, if you look, where there's very little interaction. And if we look at the general direction in which the groundwater is flowing, particularly in the White Bear Lake area, you can see that generally in high, there's very little surface water contribution to these wells. There's one exception here, but that's right along the lake, Shoren. But I think what we're seeing is groundwater flows in here, picks up a lot of water that's discharging from White Bear Lake, and then gets it taken in through the wells. Now, there's other places here that are showing contributions that are surface water, and a lot of those are because if you imagine, the Prairie du Chien aquifer actually gets shallower as you go further up north. And so these wells are screened in these aquifers, and they get shallow and shallower in depth as you go up north. So I was mentioning we had continuous seismic reflection work, and this is actually a waterborne geophysical method, and we worked with the USGS Office of Geophysics, they actually came up and brought this equipment to us. And what it is basically, you picture it, it's kind of a enhanced fish finder. Basically, it's an acoustic signal that's sent out. And this is the unit we tow right next to a boat. It's called a tow fish, and that produces the signal, and it also collects the signal. It's basically like a hydrophone within the unit itself. So if you picture it, it's sending out multiple frequencies of different sonic signals, bounces down, comes off the bottom of the lake, and we get profiles that then we can interpret using that. And so we started using this tool to really determine what the lake sediment structures were and the geology. And we did this in November of 2013. And I had never used the equipment before. And so we got it for a week, 2 weeks. And I thought, okay, we're going to focus on White Bear Lake, figure that out. It took us 2 days to get all the profiling done to White Bear Lake. So then we decided, let's just keep going. And we got 6 lakes done in the Northeast metro area that we can look at and compare to. And so how do we use this data to look at groundwater surface water interactions? Well, this is 2 sites, P1, P2, in White Bear Lake, where we installed piezometers, deep water piezometers, and I'll talk about those later. But you can see each one of these sites, we had a nest of piezometers. And we also did the lake cores. And we used that information to looked at the seismic profiles, which are the black lines through here and areas, to interpret what the geology is in the sediments. So if we look at P1, when we look at the lake core, this brown area through here is the organic sediments on the bottom of the lake. And you can see that it is indicated as this portion right through here as a signature. It's a light signal that comes through this signature. But then as you go down deeper, you can see the layers. And this is actually like a sediment basin, if you picture it, in the lower part of the level. So if you look at this, here's the bottom of the lake. Here's the organic sediment through here. I apologize for everyone over here if you can't see. But then this is the hard bottom. And so we can look at those areas and figure out kind of what the geology is. But one thing we also found quickly enough when we went through these sediments is that there's a lot of areas where you get these black sections through here. Those represent areas where you have trapped gases. If you picture, remember the methane gases? Well, I think that's what we've got here. And if you look, they typically occur when you get thicker sections of the organic matter. This is actually the core. The organic matter ran from here, which is the bottom of the lake here, and went down this deep. Where it's shallow through here, the organic thickness is low, you don't see the trapped gases. But then once it gets to a certain point, all of a sudden you start seeing these trapped gases. And so what we interpret that is those are areas where we probably have very little interaction exchanges because the gases are there, plus you've got thick organic material, which typically is pretty low permeability. And so we could go through these and interpret our seismic work and come up with areas which we think are potentially where groundwater could be inflowing and where it could be little in interaction. And so we went through, these are 2 lakes, Pleasant Lake and Big Marine Lake. And if you look at these squiggly lines are all our boat traffic as far as where we went to do our profiling. And areas which are yellow, the yellow areas are areas where we had very little trapped gases, and it indicated that we probably got hard sediments, probably sands and clays, sands and maybe clays, but in gravels. And then those are typically at the deeper depths, or the ones in the yellow, where we had the orange sections is where we had low gases closer to the shore in the shallow sediments. But then we had these brown sections, and those are areas where we have found the trapped gases. And so if you can look, there's a lot of, through Pleasant Lake, we found a lot of areas where there potentially could be groundwater interactions, exchanges with the surface water. What you need to do is probably put in more lines of evidence, like piezometers, like we did in White Bear Lake, but to confirm that. But those are areas which you can use as a map for figuring out what may be areas of potential groundwater interactions. Here's Big Marine Lake. We had fewer of those sites where we had deeper water, porous, more permeable sediments. And then here's White Bear Lake and Turtle Lake. Turtle Lake, we had fewer, but a few locations where we had some low gas and more permeable sediments. But White Bear, we had a large section down through here and a few sections in that southeast bay where we had potential for water leaving the system interactions. And so what we did, we picked out four locations where we installed piezometer nests to monitor the water level below the lake to see, do we see water level data that's indicating downward flow of lake water into the lake sediments? So, and Jared was the one who did the most of the design on these piezometers, but here's the actually one of the sites where we have a piezometer, and if you look at the construction, here's the water surface. We drilled down during March when we had ice thickness, and we drilled down till we could get down as deep as possible. And this was, it varied from different piezometers, but we got deep as 30 feet below the bottom of the lake into the lake bed, and then as shallow as one of us 6 to 8 feet below the interface. And so a lot of these places we were actually in what we interpreted to be glacial material, and so below the lake. And what was kind of ingenious was Jared constructed it so we could actually, when the ice was forming or when the ice was going out, we could actually bend the pipes down so that then we wouldn't lose the piezometers. And then once we either had the ice off or the ice fully on, we could then cut a hole in the ice and bring these back up. And so we could actually monitor during the winter periods. So this is water level data from two of our nests from 2014. We could only keep these on for 1 year because the boaters didn't like them. In fact, when we pulled them out, we actually found one propeller hooked up to one of them. So if you're missing a propeller and you were on White Bear Lake and you lost it, come to me. Anyways, so the blue is actually the water levels for White Bear Lake. Some we actually had level loggers we could monitor continuously over time. Others we just took measurements, physical measurements of the water level. But if you notice, these are all at different depths, and the deeper ones are the ones in the red. And what we found was that basically on average, it was about 0.2, 0.3 feet lower in water level in the deepest piezometer of the nests. So it indicates here further evidence that at these sites there's a potential for downward flow. One other thing we wanted to do is look at the water quality. One thing we wanted to see is, could we sample the water from the piezometers and see maybe the isotope signature? Is that changing to indicate, does it represent more of the lake water than what we're seeing with the groundwater system? And we did some depth profiling within the lake, and so we could establish here was the thermocline, and we wanted to see, make sure if we see any changes in the isotope ratios. And this is the one for the hydrogen ratio, and this is the oxygen. And there is some variability, but in general, there wasn't that much of a difference below the thermocline. But then when we looked at the bathymeter for the isotope ratios, this is what we found as far as plots go. And they were closer to the lake water representation than what we were seeing in the groundwater system. And so that provided us, again, further information that indicates that maybe this is we're receiving more lake water coming into the system, into the where the piezometer is, at the piezometer depth. So we worked with Don Rosenberry, and here's Don right here. And we're putting in our deep water seepage meters. And so we measured seepage meter fluxes in March of 2014, and then we did shallow water ones along the shorelines in August. And one thing we were seeing is when we took measurements, all the flow measurements indicated we were getting downward flow of lake water flowing down into the deeper aquifers. Now, the flow rates were generally from 0.04 to 1 inch per day. When we compared that where we monitored inflow near the shallow along the shorelines of White Bear Lake, if we measured through here, you can see in most cases where we took our measurements, we were seeing inflow coming in. And the flow rates were much higher. We were seeing from 0.1 to 11 inches per day. And so we are seeing outflow. So if you picture, we see groundwater coming in and the near shores flying in. And then we're seeing outflow going out, but it's at a much slower rate in the deeper water sections. And so what's this telling us is that, again, what we're seeing is that we're seeing this interaction of groundwater inflow. There's probably lake water leaving out towards Bald Eagle Lake along the shoreline, but we never actually found a place that actually saw that. But just from the head difference, I think there's probably some there. But we are seeing lake water outflow going through the bottom as far as what we're seeing. And one thing we found with the lake sediments is that when we're doing some of our groundwater flow modeling, we're finding out that that's a really important variable controlling the flow rates of water coming into the different lakes. And so that's a parameter that we really need to get a better handle on. So with our results, what we're finding is that the stable isotope ratios and other information that we're collecting, the water level data, as well as the seepage data, is indicating that we're getting water leaving the lake, flowing down, and the well ratios are indicating that we're getting water reaching the Prairie du Chien aquifer in parts of the Northeast Metro, at least particularly in the White Bear Lake area is what we're seeing. And at the interactions in White Bear Lake, we're seeing, again, near shore, we're seeing groundwater flows flowing into the lake, probably higher rates than what we're seeing in lake water. In the deeper water sections where we're seeing, again, lake water leaving and flowing into the sediments. And the seepage rates, again, are in the near shore are higher than what we're seeing in the deep water. And so, as I mentioned, our report is out. It's online. here is the location. If you just type in USGS Northeast Lakes, and probably in 2016, you'll probably get it. See a link to it, but otherwise here's the link for that. And lastly, if this all works right, I'd like to show at least one of the seismic profiles so people can see it. Let me show you. I think what we're going to show you is this one right here. So let me see if it'll come up. That was my last slide. So it's kind of the results. If you have questions, I'm here to take them.
Hey, Perry, just a question for you on your seismic device. What was the source of that? What do they use for a source?
It's an acoustic source. Call it a chirp system. And so it just sends out multiple signals at different frequencies, a whole range of frequencies, and so that you get the best profile that comes through. So a lot of them are higher. And you can set the frequency range that you want to work with according to what the conditions are. You may want higher conditions if you've got more murkier waters and things like this. Yeah. Okay, the first thing to note, I'm going to let you know, is that when you look at this, this is actually the data you want to look at. And you notice these dark sections? That's where we're getting trapped gases. You can't see anything past this. But these, all the signals down here, they're multiples. So you can ignore that data. It's really just a mimicking what you're seeing at this upper level. Oh, great. So if you picture this, this is actually, you're running the boat, and this is what we see. So right here, that's the beginning. And you can see, you actually can map out the milfoil with this, which is kind of cool. Let's get a better signal. Here we go. Here's a sediment basin here. This little signature through here, I don't know if you can see, it's very light. That's where the organic matter is. Here we go. There's the trapped gases through here. And you will see that, and I'll show you a little bit later, that it occurs when you get a meter or more thickness of the organic matter. Here's bottoms where we're getting less trapped gases. And those are areas where, again, where it's deep, where you potentially could be getting interactions. And here we go, more trapped gases, and then they go away. As you go up, here's our milfoil right there. So, you know, that's something to look at. In fact, the White Bear Conservation District would probably love to look at that because they're all concerned about milfoil. But let me run this through again, and I'll stop it here. And tell me if you're bored. I think this is cool. Sure, yes, definitely. No, I was talking to some people in geophysics, and a lot of them don't do that. But here, this is, and you'll see this here. You can see the different layerings of the clay layers, the dark ones, and then the finer sediments here. And again, here's the lake bottom. You come through, there's a little plant activity there. But here is the top, actually the bottom of the lake. And so this light material, I don't know if you can see it really good, but through here, that's the organic matter. And you can see that it's typically, you know, this is probably a little less than a meter, maybe close to a meter. But you don't get any trapped gases there. A lot of those shallow layers are clays. And some of them could be, but I don't think in that case it's because they're thin. They're pretty thin. No, unfortunately, as you can see here, right here is a multiple. So we could only get down several meters. And the bedrock's probably, it's probably 80, 70 feet, depends on where we are below that. And so we couldn't actually map out the bedrocks with this. But you know, one thing that we do want to do, there's another method, EM method, which we could actually try to map out that, at least the top of the top of the bedrock we could map out. And we've talked about trying to do that, particularly at White Bear Lake. A lot of the lakes in the Northeast Metros, you get a buried valley system running through them. And White Bear Lake is one that they have a buried valley. And really, it never has been really mapped out as effectively where the deeper sections of the lake are. And so it's something where we'd like to do it in the future. But I can tell you here, right at this location where the arrow is, that's about a meter. And then all of a sudden, as soon as it looks like it gets deeper, the organic material, you can't see it because this is all organic matter with trapped gas in it. And trapped gas, what happens to the signal? It gets kind of absorbed, and so it just goes away. You can't interpret anything below that.
Perry, I was wondering if you could just say, I'm right here, a couple of words about the SF6 results and why they ended up not being useful. I think this audience would find that problem interesting.
Yeah, that was one issue. We with the age dating, we found out when we got our values back for the SF6, that the concentrations were showing that there was potentially some kind of natural contamination there. And after talking with some people from Wisconsin, U.S. Geological Survey, and from some people who've done some work in other parts of the upper Midwest, they've had similar problems with sulfur hexafluoride. There's some type of natural source. It could be the dolomite. It could from the Prairie du Chien or other sources that could be providing extra SF6 that then takes away that atmospheric source that you need to actually date the waters. And so we found out we couldn't use any of that data. And that was news to me, and I found out that recently that's news to a lot of people. And so I'd caution you, if you're ever thinking of using SF6, make sure that you take one sample, get it analyzed, and see if you're finding out contamination. We were able to age date 9 of the 40 wells we sampled. The other problem was when we did that using CFC data, and when we used that, we were able to get dates that range from the 1940s to the mid-1970s range. And a lot of the 1970 range were those wells that are south of White Bear Lake. The problem is interpreting some of that data. A lot of the wells that we sampled, because there just weren't a lot of wells to sample from there, had very large screened intervals. They were municipal wells. And so how to interpret that, even though it's very young, you could have water that's really young mixing in with really old water, or you could have in different parts of the screened interval, or you could have water that's the same age, but it's really hard to interpret unless you know where the water is coming from as far as contributions to the wells. And that information just isn't around.
Yeah, how did you measure your evaporation?
As far as evaporation rates, in what sense? Oh, you mean as far as the lake goes?
Yeah.
Well, we just used the stable isotope work and used the relationships that we were finding, that linear pattern. And from that, you can actually get an evaporation line that gives you the evaporation rates. It's basically the slope of that line.
You spoke quickly about it, but did you say the trapped gas indicates whether or not there's any lake water going into or out of the sediments?
The trapped gases really, from my standpoint, indicates that there's not that much movement either way. Because the gases are there, they're tight materials, and almost typically every time we found the trapped gases, when we compared that to at least the sites where we had lake cores, the organic thickness was more than a meter thick. And so the top that you've got the gases there that prevents water from moving, plus the fact that you've got really tight organic material, that's my feeling. We didn't test it in the lab or anything, but I think from that standpoint, it indicates to me that those are areas where you would not expect any kind of an exchange. And again, these are potential areas. For the seismic work, you almost have to follow it up by either putting in wells or something else to give you an indication of, is it really lake water leaving the lake, or are these just areas where you just don't have very many trapped gases, but the material may be very tight. You may be having really tight clays or something there. What's that? Ephemeral. Well, yeah. Well, they could, but I don't think that's the thing. Because the material, I think, in general, when you look at these organic layers, they're really thick. And I didn't show a core. We should have shown a core here. But they're really tight, so I don't think there's that much exchange.
Okay.